He's paid the fine since. But we find out these things about you, Steve. He also seems to have a good sense of humor. He has put up with many of us for a long period of time, and I'm glad he's still here for us to kick around a little bit as election years come and go. I'll give you Steve Shale.
Jeez, I really don't like it when so many people talk about other people without talking about me first. So Steve is someone that I trained. I made him really good. So Steve, you're welcome.
All right, well, thank you all for having me here today. I normally have a no speech rule in the month after the campaign, in part because I think we're all trying to figure out whether your candidate wins or loses, kind of what happened, and want to talk smart about it. And honestly, not to offend you, Mr. President, Jeff called me. I didn't take his call. Lucy Morgan called me, and I took her call. And I'll tell you a little story about that. So I was I got into politics again completely backwards on accident. Stumbled into it, basically now stuck in it. It's either this or Costco for me. When I was running our first campaign, I went to the Florida Democratic Party's How to Be a Campaign Manager School. One of the rules they told us was, so when reporters call, you should be very skeptical. You should, you know, be careful where you call them back. But be really careful if this lady named Lucy Morgan calls you. So about 9 o'clock at night, about 2 weeks before the election, my phone rings in our campaign office. Now, our campaign office was in my boss's insurance office. So to call the office after 5 o'clock, you had to get the number back to my desk. And it really, the only people that had that number, I thought, were Doug and my at the time, my girlfriend, now my wife. Lo and behold, Lucy Morgan got that number. So when the phone rang, wasn't quite sure what to do. I took Lucy's call then, and I would suggest everybody that they always take Lucy's call. So let me sort of start at the end on election night. Starting a couple of years ago, I made the decision to get out of sort of doing rote politics as a career. I ran President Obama's campaign in 2012. I realized I'd been on the road about 200 nights a year for going on 10 years. The smallest amount of mileage I had put on my car in a single year in the previous 10 was about, I think it was 47,000 miles. That was the least I drove in a year. And so I got out of doing campaigns as a sort of vocation. But you know, when it's in your blood, it's hard to get away from. So what I would do to keep myself occupied around campaign season is I began escorting groups of foreigners who would come into the U.S. to observe elections. The U.S. for about 40 years has brought in young professionals from around the world to see how we do our politics. So I had a group of Turks with me this year around the election. So on election night, I had been taking this group of Turks around Orlando all day. We'd been to a Republican phone bank. We'd waved signs with the Democrat. We had been and seen actual voting. And so we went to an election night party. So I take these Turks to a bar, and we're sitting there. They're drinking. And about 7 o'clock, I do what I do, which is I pull up my computer and I start looking through the data. And what was interesting for me, even though I didn't work on the Clinton campaign, as Lucy said, I failed miserably at convincing the vice president to run for president. I think a decision, quite honestly, while he won't admit it, I think a decision he regretted almost immediately. I still was obviously interested and was sort of looking at what I thought Florida was going to do. And back in late September, I looked at four different sort of models of the way the election may turn out. Two of those models had the election going to Hillary Clinton by about maybe a point and a half to 2 points. One of the models actually had it in an exact tie. I had a model that had it 4,476,000 some odd votes even. And I had a fourth model which showed Donald Trump winning by just under a point. For him to win under a point, it would require him to essentially get equal to the highest share of vote in each county that either George Bush got in 2004, which is pretty much the high water mark for Republicans, or Mitt Romney in 2012. So for him to win, basically Florida, under the new demographics of the state, he would have to do better than any Republican in the previous four election cycles in every county in Florida. Seemed like a bit of a stretch. Kind of as early voting began to kind of play itself out, I was sort of looking for some different trend lines. And what we were seeing initially, the first week of early voting, if you were a Trump person, you should have felt pretty good about it. But as the week went on, and as sort of the data came in from around the state, as we saw the demographics of the state really sort of show up in early voting, it looked more and more like Hillary Clinton was going to win Florida. And so basically going into Election Day, I thought that Hillary Clinton had, you know, roughly a 200,000 vote lead. Now, but by comparison, Barack Obama had a 150,000 vote lead going into Election Day in 2008 and won. So for that, under that scenario, Donald Trump would have to win Election Day in Florida by 9 points. Mitt Romney won Election Day by 5 points. So again, we're talking about really sort of historic things. Well, turns out I was actually really wrong. Hillary Clinton was ahead by more than that going into Election Day. She was ahead in Florida by 4 points, 247,000 votes going into Election Day, and ended up losing because Donald Trump didn't win Election Day by 9 points. He won it by 13 points, which is an unheard of, sort of unprecedented amount of number. So on Election Night, Steve Burtman asked me kind of when I knew it was going south. You know, it's interesting, going into Election Day, you know, while some of my Republican friends now like to point out that they were right, almost every Republican that texted me on Election Day thought Trump was going to lose, including people in Donald Trump's own campaign, because of the numbers that were out there. But what was, if you looked at the early voting returns in places like here in Leon County, was sort of record early voting numbers in Miami-Dade and in Broward County. Hillary Clinton had a 500,000 vote lead, just the early votes. She was winning in Duval County, which is a Republican county. George Bush won Duval County by 61,000 votes in 2004, and Hillary Clinton was winning after the early vote. She was winning in Seminole County, one of the most traditional Republican counties in the state, was winning in Sarasota County in the early voting. So at 7:15, I got a phone call from the Hillary Clinton campaign asking me kind of what I thought. What's interesting, it was probably the first campaign call I actually got from the Hillary Clinton campaign asking what I thought. But they called me at 7:15 and asked me what I thought. I was like, hey, I think you guys have got this thing in the bag. And then slowly, the counties along the Interstate 4 corridor, Lake County, Seminole County, came in with Election Day, Pasco County, north of Tampa, Hernando County, north of Tampa, Manatee County, south of Tampa, Polk County, Volusia County, which used to be one of the most Democratic counties in the state, came in with Election Day. And by 7:45, I knew it was over. It was interesting. I was actually looking back at my text messages the other night, and as early as 7:47, I was telling people at CNN they could call the election for Trump, for Florida. They didn't call it till after 10. But basically, for Democrats to win Florida, they have to be ahead by about 180,000 to 200,000 votes before the panhandle counties come in. You know, we have 10 counties in Florida that vote in the central time zone. And Republicans win those counties in presidential elections routinely by 170,000 to 190,000 votes in each of the last 5 or 6 elections. It's one of the most consistent. There's almost no movement to it. And at that point, there were just not enough votes out there for it to play itself out. So let's talk a little bit about how I think that happened and kind of where we go from here. I want to throw a couple numbers out here that I think are just fascinating. In the last 40 years, since 1976, 1.175 billion votes have been cast for president in the United States. Anybody want to harbinger a guess at how close the Republican and Democratic nominees are in total votes out of 1.175 billion votes? Try 2 million. So out of 1.175 million billion votes in the United States since 1976, the margin, Democrats have a 2 million vote advantage. In other words, 0.2% of the election. Florida's even closer than that since 1992. So Florida, prior to 1992, wasn't really a battleground state. It was either a safe Democratic state for years or was a safe Republican state during the Reagan-Bush years. 92, we become a swing state. Since 92, 50 million people have cast a ballot for president in the United States, in Florida. The Democrats have a small margin of advantage, 18,000 votes. 18,000 out of that would put us inside the margin of a hand recount in Florida. Y'all remember this, you know, from 2000, is 0.25%. That margin is 0.04%. So that's just how close Florida is. Go back just the last 4 statewide elections, the last 2 governor's races and the last 2 presidentials. 30 million total votes, 36,000 votes separating Republicans and Democrats in the last 2 presidentials and the last 2 governor's races. All 4 of those elections had a margin of 1 point. And what's interesting about Florida is it's not, and I'm going to talk about this in a second, it's not like we have these huge places of swing vote. Over those four elections, 61 counties in Florida voted for the same party each time. Like Leon County, for example, always votes Democratic. You know, go down south of us, Wakulla County, always votes Republican. So only six counties out of 67 over those four elections. And if you go back to 08, it's 59 out of 67 counties have voted for the same party every single time. So sort of why, what makes Florida so close? Well, from my perspective, what makes Florida interesting is that it's unlike any other place in the country, in that it's not really a place. You know, if you think about a place like, if you think about a state like Iowa, or you think about a Michigan or a Texas, you know, California, New York, there's something about that place that gives an identity. You think about the states that Trump won in the upper Midwest. There's something that sort of commonality of experience that sort of you can explain what happened. The thing about Florida, the common experience we all have is that we live under the same border. And that's really about it. You know, and Florida is a sort of huge, massive place. It takes less time to drive from Pensacola, Florida to Louisville than it does to drive from Pensacola to Miami. And I would argue that the difference, the cultural difference between Pensacola and Miami is even bigger than that. You know, I sort of think of the state as really sort of five different states. And I'm going to get back to the politics, but I think it's sort of important context. And you think about those places in Florida and how big and powerful they are in their own right. Florida in itself is the 17th largest economy in the world. Our state economy is roughly the same size as Turkey, which is pretty remarkable. But within Florida itself, we have these places that are really powerful. Miami would be the 32nd largest economy in the world, roughly on par with Hong Kong, which I think is sort of interesting because I think Miami will one day be very much like Hong Kong, as Hong Kong is a entry point to a continent. I think Miami will view it very much as almost like a city-state like Hong Kong that's an entry point to a region in Latin America as we go forward. Even a place like Tampa is the 57th largest state economy in the world. It would be as its own state bigger than Oregon. Or Orlando, which is our fastest growing media market in the country, has a larger GDP than Kuwait. And will overtake both Tampa and Miami as the largest places, largest population centers in the state in the next 15 years. So we have this sort of really vast, interesting place that when you add all these pieces together, they just happen to be competitive. There's nothing competitive about Florida innately. You know, Iowa is competitive because virtually everybody in Iowa does the same thing, and they live in small communities, and they talk to each other in places like this all day long. Florida's competitive because we have all these interesting groups of people that just add up to the same. You know, Anderson Cooper, you may remember during the coverage of Katrina, was standing in that, you know, his like, you know, boggy sort of outfit in the water, and he referred to the water in Katrina as a toxic gumbo. And I think in a lot of ways, it's an apt description for our population here in Florida. the sum of all the parts is what makes the state sort of fascinating. So let's talk about how you win Florida, and then we'll talk about how Trump won Florida, and then I'll take some questions. So I like analogies. Think about Florida as a scale. If you take the four media markets that Republicans win all the time, essentially Pensacola, Panama City, Jacksonville, and Fort Myers. Then you take the Democratic media markets, Gainesville, Tallahassee, Miami, and West Palm Beach. And you take the margin of victory out of each one of those places. It traditionally, over time, basically is a scale. Those two buckets weigh about the same. And then I-4, the Tampa and Orlando media market, sort of acts as the fulcrum. And where that tips is where the state turns. And if you go back to, say, 2000, you'll see that the Republicans won their markets by about the same as Democrats, and that I-4 tipped by about 227 votes more for Bush, and that's how he won. Well, what's interesting is as the state has changed over the years, as places like Miami-Dade County have become more Democratic. Remember, people that have followed politics 8 years ago, or I'm sorry, 16 years ago, Miami-Dade was a swing county in Florida politics. Clearly Clinton won by 31 points last year. I mean, that's just how much the demographics have changed. So these days now, the way the state works is that your Democratic buckets are much bigger than your Republican buckets. Give you an example. Hillary Clinton won the Democratic counties, our markets, by 141,000 more votes than Trump won the Republican bucket. So in other words, Trump didn't win because he turned out huge numbers of Republicans in base Republican areas. He didn't win because the Panhandle showed up in massive numbers and voted for him. Donald Trump won the panhandle by 20,000 more votes than Mitt Romney, who won it by 25,000 more votes than John McCain. So again, not a huge significant thing. He won Fort Myers by about 40,000 more votes than Mitt Romney. Not a huge shift in the overall sort of electorate when you compare it to how he won. So what happened? Interstate 4 changed this year in a big way. So what is the I-4 corridor? We talk about it a lot. Tampa and Orlando media markets. 46% of the statewide vote lives in the Tampa and Orlando media markets. Again, just to put it in some context, the same number of people voted on the I-4 corridor is voted in the swing state of North Carolina. So huge area. The two most advertised in media markets in the country this last year were Tampa and Orlando. If you had a television in Tampa and Orlando and you did not throw it out of your window at some point during the campaign, I want to ask you why. And what's interesting about those counties is that Hillary Clinton actually, despite losing the election there, did better in Tampa and Orlando proper than Barack Obama did. But where she lost the election were in those places that between 715 and 745 came in and reported data, places like Pasco County, that Barack Obama lost by 7,000 votes in 2008. She lost by 53,000 votes. Volusia County, that Barack Obama in 2008 won by 13,000 votes. She lost by 33,000 votes. Sarasota County, the one that still gets at me. Sarasota County was the county in 08 that I wanted to win, that I thought that nobody thought we could win, and we came 218 votes short, not that I've forgotten the exact number. Trump won it by about 25,000 votes. So in these 14 or 15 counties along the I-4, suburban, exurban counties around the I-4 corridor, Trump, his margin of victory was 230,000 votes more than Mitt Romney's in those places, in those just 15 places. And that's where he won the election. And what's interesting about those places, think about how people come to Florida. If you think about Florida is a migratory path. People come to Miami because they come up from the south. People who live up here, generally more of them are from here. They'll say in Florida is to go south, you go north. But people in Tampa and Orlando got here by interstates. So where do people who live in Tampa, what interstate goes north? I-75. What's an I-75? You know, places like Wisconsin, Michigan, Indiana, Iowa. People who live in Daytona and places around Lake County and Brevard County, they came down I-95. Where does that go? Pennsylvania and places like that, obviously farther northeast too. But so the same voters that elected Donald Trump in places like Pennsylvania and Iowa and Michigan and Wisconsin, the same voters who elected Barack Obama 48 years earlier were the same voters in Florida who elected Donald Trump. So two last points, and then I'll stop talking and let y'all ask some questions. First is, I think that it's really important, and I say this not because my candidate lost, though my candidate actually didn't run. just to be clear, there are a few other draft Biden people in the room. I'll be quiet to not. Frankly, we had two of the most flawed candidates running for president in the history of our country, I honestly believe that Joe Biden would have beaten Donald Trump like a drum, and frankly, I think that almost any other Republican who had run this year would have beaten Hillary Clinton like one. I think Mitt Romney, Romney or Bush or Rubio or anybody else would have beaten Clinton very easily. We had the two sort of most flawed candidates in history. And so I think it's sort of important, not in history, but in a very long time. So I think it's sort of important to not sort of overread this election. Because what's interesting is even though Trump won, Democrats won governorships in places like North Carolina. Which doesn't happen very often. So it's not like this was just a sort of one-party thing. This was basically a race to the bottom campaign. Frankly, my party doesn't win races to the bottom. There are more Republican voters who vote every election than Democrats. So when my party gets into elections that are just races to the bottom, we don't win. We have to inspire people, a la what Barack Obama did 4 years earlier. It's going to be interesting to see how Trump reads it. I think based on his Twitter feed, he is definitely misreading the mandate. This is the 10th closest election in American history by the Electoral College. It is the largest minority sort of election in terms of the candidate winning the Electoral College but losing the popular vote. Hillary Clinton now has a 2.3 million vote lead in the popular vote. And I say that not to say that she won. I say that to say that it's really easy for folks like Donald Trump, in a lot of ways like Barack Obama did 8 years earlier, to misread the election. And what's interesting about the last 10 years in American politics, we've had four of the last six election cycles are wave election years. We've not seen that kind of instability in American politics since the 1890s. So think about that. Our politics is more unstable today than it was during two world wars, a Great Depression, and the Civil Rights era. And I think it's Americans sort of just calling out, sort of crying out for, you know, for please, Washington, actually functional, do something. And so I do think that Trump runs the same risk as the president does of misreading it as a mandate for him. And I think if he does that, we will very likely in 2018 see the fourth consecutive wave year election that it sort of goes against the party's incumbent president. So with that, I could talk a whole lot more, but I figure it's more interesting to take questions. So I will, I'll stop. I don't know how y'all do this, but.
Questions are for only Tiger Bay members can ask questions, okay? Nobody else can sneak in.
I can't ask myself a question? Yes, ma'am.
This is going
My name is Janice Flake, and I've looked carefully at this whole election. You know, it's not over. The real election is on December the 19th. And I've looked at the Constitution. There is nothing in the Constitution about states going with winner takes all. Further, I have looked at the four key states that were close: Florida, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. And according to my calculations, if they did it proportionally, instead of his having 75 votes, he would only, ahead of Hillary, he would only have less than one vote. And I think we need to really look at the Electoral College. I think it's bogus. Further, I want to point out that if you're not happy with the election, the Electoral College has opened up a line for people to put their put information in. And you can either email me and I'll send you the link. My email is jflake@fsu.edu, or you can go on Google and search for input to the Electoral College. This isn't over yet.
So I'm going to make one comment on the Electoral College, because I think it's sort of interesting. Probably one of the most fascinating things I've gotten to do in my career was pick the 27 electors who voted for Barack Obama in 2008. And it was there are two ways of doing it. Typically, they just kind of go to party people who, you know, just keep showing up to meetings and aren't necessarily doing anything other than just, you know, have titles. To me, it was actually really important for Barack Obama's electors to represent the kind of values he did. And so we spent a lot of time, or I spent a lot of time, probably more time than I should have, really thinking through it. And, you know, we... For example, we had the first African American sergeant major in the Army was one of his electors, and we found a woman who was a neat community organizer in Hialeah, and tried to come up with people that had different stories in their own right. But what's the one thing about electors is they're picked by the candidates. So you know, while there have been faithless electors over time, there are one or two, maybe at most. You will not see any change in the Electoral College this year, because I mean they're slates that are delivered by the campaigns to the state. And I will tell you, in 2008, the morning the Electoral College met in Tallahassee, I got a phone call from David Plouffe, and he was like, "Steve, make sure your state doesn't F it up again."
Speaking of misreading the results, do you think Bernie Sanders misread the votes for him that were really a vote against Hillary as being a vote for him? And if so, is the Democrat Party misreading the results as a hint to move to the left?
Listen, I come at the world here probably from a different perspective. I may be the last. So I grew up in politics sort of under what they used to call the median voter theory, which basically you win elections by having the candidate that is closest to the median ideological voter in a given race. And so, you know, my first campaign is my friend David Daniel and I worked on way back in the day. I do think, David, I think you still owe me a beer from that campaign, though, because you told me that Clinton would win the district, and I don't think he did. But I remember like not looking at things in terms of R versus D, but I looked at them in terms of how many votes we had to get in a precinct to win. And so, I just don't fundamentally believe, as much as we talk about how divided politics are, that we are really that divided. There's an interesting book by a guy named Morris Fiorina, who's a Stanford political scientist, called Culture War. And his whole entire book debunks the idea that there's a culture war. Essentially says that even on the issues that have the greatest amount of angst, take an issue like gun control. We talk about gun control as being here or here, when the reality is that like 75% of people in America don't think the people that are on a no-fly list should have a gun. Like there's consensus. And that I think that, to your point, I think that both parties continue to misread these back and forth elections as a complete repudiation of the other party and a complete endorsement of something else. And I think it's just voters saying, come on, guys, none of y'all can get anything together. We're going to keep sending a message until somebody figures it out. I think one of these days somebody's going to figure out that you can run for office on a fiscal conservative, social libertarian message that appeals across party lines, and I think is going to win 400 electoral votes. But the problem is that both parties, the primaries have become so insane, frankly. I have a lot of good friends who are Republicans, and believe it or not, and my friends in Bush world, I remember asking them early on, how are you going to win a primary when 60% of your primary voters in Iowa think that Barack Obama's a Muslim from Kenya? It's just not, you're not, and on my side, same thing. It's just it's just hard to kind of navigate. So that's the challenge, is I think these primaries are making these candidates more extreme than the country is, and I think until one of the parties or the other figures it out, we're going to keep going back and forth.
Hey, Steve. Excuse me. Please enlighten me on how the proportional representation in the Electoral College would have affected this election. You start off, I think Trump won 30 states. That's 60 electoral votes based on senators to 42 for Hillary with 2 from D.C. That leaves you with 435 congressional districts. How did they split?
I don't know. I know that in Florida, I claim to be a bit of an expert on Florida. I'm a pretty much an idiot on the rest of the country. I might even be an idiot on Florida. But it was Trump won 14 114 congressional districts in Florida. Clinton won 13. So if we allocate, so there are two states in the country that allocate their electoral college based on congressional districts. One is Nebraska. One is Maine. Basically, the winner take all that goes to the two senators at the congressional districts go that way. So, for example, Barack Obama in 2008 won the one contested congressional seat in Nebraska, won the Omaha district. So, if we had proportional in Florida, he would have gotten 16 electoral votes, and Clinton would have gotten 13. What's interesting is that Republicans in the legislature in 2000, it was right after we won in 2012. Actually considered a bill to create proportional representation out of the concern that the state was becoming too democratic in a presidential election year. And obviously, if that had happened, we would have gotten 13 electoral votes this time, they would have gotten 16. But that's how it works. There are only two states that currently do it.
Okay.
Hi.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm Pat Owen, and my question is this. To what do you attribute the polling debacle?
Well, so what's interesting about the polling thing is, and there are a couple of things that are going on. The first is that, those of y'all that know me or follow me on Twitter or whatever, I think that Charlie Cook, who's a really smart sort of national political observer, he's not a hack like me, he's an actual student of science, years ago said of public polling that 95% of it is equal to dime store junk. Most public polling is really bad. First of all, a lot of it, is, they don't do live phone calls or they're doing these robo things where they call and you don't even know who you're talking to. Very few public polls most public polling does what they call, it's just random sample. So they'll take a phone book, basically, they'll pull a random sample out of a phone book and then they'll poll off of that. Candidates don't do that. Candidates use voter lists. There was only one pollster in the country this year that used voter file, and that was the New York Times. And I think they probably had the best polling in the country. So first of all, you got that. Second of all, national polls are just stupid. I mean, you're talking about 800 people out of 120 million people. You're going to have huge shifts and all that. And so, you know, I think there's that. In Florida, the polling actually wasn't very off. And if you look at places like North Carolina and sort of the big swing states, Pennsylvania maybe being the exception, it wasn't really all that off. But clearly, you know, I think there wasn't, in places like Michigan and Wisconsin, which typically don't get the kind of, you know, Florida gets a lot of public polling. So the public pollsters have actually gotten halfway decent at it because they understand the state. You know, people that are going into Michigan may be doing it for the very first time. So I think that's part of it. But frankly, a lot of it is just that media outlets do polls because they're cheap and they drive cheap news. And, you know, hopefully maybe the lesson of, though I doubt it sincerely, hopefully one of the things that comes out of this election is that media is a little bit more cautious in the way that they spin their own lousy numbers.
Stephen, my question's about the direction of future campaigning. A couple of factoids I've learned since Election Day. I guess it was at Tiger Bay we learned, at Tiger at Bay, we learned that there was, it takes now 15 pieces of direct mail to have the opening grade of one in the past. And things like Bernie Sanders greatly outspent Donald Trump in television advertising in Florida.
Hillary Clinton?
Bernie Sanders.
Oh, yeah. I don't think that's
outspent
accurate.
Donald Trump.
That's not accurate.
At least from the campaign.
Yeah, Bernie didn't spend any money here.
Yeah, okay. All right.
It might have been national.
It was third party, but let me go on.
Yeah.
Facebook tells us that something like 670 million hits on election day and like 10 billion hits on political related things in the year leading up to the election. Everything, the dynamics of campaigning are changing in a big, big way. Where do you see them going?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, what's interesting is that, you know, before, if you go back to sort of like politics 100 years ago, how did we do politics? We did it like this. You know, you would talk to your friends and your neighbors and your, you know, and, you know, you talk to people at work and people at church, and that's how you did politics. And we got away from that. But what's interesting is as the world is getting more just cluttered, I mean, there was a study about, this was about 10 years ago, and I'm sure this number has dramatically increased. About 10 years ago, the average person in the U.S. was hit by 1,000 different advertisements in a day. You know, and so, and this is the average voter, about the same time, I think David, you and I were at the same conference when we said this, the average swing voter spends like an hour a year actively thinking about who they're going to vote for. So if you're a candidate and you're like, you're trying to operate in the space of there's just all this noise already, and people already don't trust what you're going to say, and, oh, by the way, they're really busy and they're not paying attention. I think we're going to get back to that. One thing is back to sort of the old way of doing it. And, you know, I think you talk about Facebook. It was interesting. When I was in my 30s, I went back to grad school with Florida State. It's a great game, all you Gators in the room. Great game on Saturday night. One little thing I'll tell you. So I did Chuck Todd's show actually, both the day after FSU beat Miami in 2015, and in 2016, and in 2015 I went on with a FSU tie. He's a big University of Miami guy, with an FSU tie and a Florida State helmet in the shelf behind. And in 2016 I had the guy, you know, you'll see like the fake backdrop on. I had him put Doe Campbell Stadium. So, which I got a very funny text message about after. It's like, I saw that. But I mean, you know, when I went back to grad school, I did some research into Facebook and how college students were using Facebook. And what was interesting is that where people like us, you know, I put myself kind of right at the bridge of generations, sort of look to opinion leaders, people with political capital, people in groups like this to help give us direction. In among younger voters, they looked at their peers on Facebook for direction. The political capital was earned a different way through social media. So I think that social media will actually get us away from some of the current ways we do persuasion into more sort of interpersonal. But what the hard thing for campaigns is you never want to be the campaign that loses because you did something completely different. And that's part of the problem that why campaigns always lag behind other marketing things. Because it's easy to lose if you're the campaign that, oh, you know, I put 2,000 points a week up on TV in Tampa, and well, it just didn't work out. Like, that's a defensible thing. Like, oh, I didn't do any TV, and that's why we lost. Like, you're never going to get hired again. So I think that it's going to take campaigns longer to get there, but I do think we will move back towards using things like social media for persuasion, interpersonal, one-on-one, unless, I hope at least.
Two questions.
Yes, sir.
First, do you think it's realistic to put a lot of effort and energy into trying to abolish the Electoral College?
No.
So long as one party's going to favor it, one won't, depending upon who wins and who loses.
Yeah.
And my second question is, after all the dust has settled, only five states flipped. And if any of the three had not, you wouldn't be here. Your counterpart would be here today.
Well,
my question is this.
If she called me, I'd still been here.
Okay. Since one of the states is our state, what would you advise the Democrat leadership, whatever it may be, whenever it's decided, what needs to be done to flip Florida back?
So here's sort of two factoids, and I was waiting for that question. I cut it out of my speech because I knew I'd get asked at one point. So two factoids. First of all, talk about how arbitrary the Electoral College is. And first of all, the Electoral College is here to stay. Mending the Constitution is exceptionally hard. I can't imagine that we would do it for that. We can talk about it, but it's not going to happen. Whether or not more states go to proportional, that may happen, you know, over time. But I think the Electoral College is a feature that's here to stay. What was I going to say beyond that? But on the state, like, if you move 250,000 votes in Florida, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, Hillary Clinton has 307 electoral votes. I mean, that's how close the election was. And there's a guy who put on the internet this thing where you can actually move counties just across borders. And I played with it for about 5 minutes yesterday. If you move three southern counties from Michigan into Ohio, and you move Escambia, Santa Rosa, and Okaloosa into Alabama, Hillary Clinton's president. I mean, that's just how close this thing was. As I said, it certainly wasn't a mandate. Going forward, listen, I mean, I think there's a roadmap. I mean, my party lost the White House in 2004 the same way they lost it in 2016. They were hyper-focused on turnout and very sort of narrowly cast universes of people. They've got great instruments to help identify who are these sort of low propensity Hispanic voters and et cetera. But she didn't have a clarion call and for a message for getting elected. And I think if you look back at what Barack Obama did in 2007, 2008, Obama often sort of tells the story of going to a fish fry in a county in Iowa that he knew he was going to get 28% of the vote in. And they asked him, why'd you go? He's like, well, if I can get 28 to 30%, those are people who are voting for me too. And so I think, you know, for my party, it's taking the broader view of the fact. If Hillary Clinton, if Democrats get the same share of the white vote that Barack Obama got in 2008 in Florida, 41% of the vote, they will never lose a statewide election in Florida again. It's really that simple, the way the demographics are changing. And so, and it really is, it's again, taking places like Pasco County that we lost by 7,000 votes, in part because we put a lot of effort in it. I mean, I took Joe Biden to Newport Richey. I took Joe Biden to the villages. I mean, we took Barack Obama to Jacksonville three times. But you know, that's also because we knew that, you know, Florida's all about controlling margins, and if we could keep the margins close in these places, that we could win. And so that's, you know, the lesson going forward is frankly to look at history. And you know, a lot of people, including Hillary Clinton, learned a lot of the wrong lessons from Barack Obama's campaign. I wish they'd called.
My name is Grail Farr. One of the most distressing things to me about this most recent electoral cycle was the tendency across the country for local governments to restrict the electoral process to eliminate or make it very difficult for whole demographics to participate. And I'd like to know what you think about that and what do we look for in the future under the Trump administration.
Listen, I think this voter fraud thing that's out there right now is absolutely abysmal. And it's not only because it's a lie, it's because it plays into the basic cynicism people have about institutions. And frankly, like, I think that all of us in the process, whether we win or lose, and one of the reasons why I think so highly of Governor Kottkamp is, you know, we all have a responsibility to defend the institutions. And, you know, and so when folks like Donald Trump go out and talk about fraud, or when people on my side talk about the fact that we didn't lose, like, that's not healthy. And so I think, first of all, I hope that the president-elect, and who I do wish well, because as President Obama said, if he does well, America does well. But I hope he does sort of stop talking about this issue of fraud, which didn't exist. I mean, the reality is, we had to spend somewhere between $5 and $6 million in 2008 educating people about the new voting laws that were passed before the 08 election. And, you know, with today's data, you know, real-time data on voter registration, there really is, it's incredibly hard to fraud the system, and I think a lot of these are solutions in search of a problem that doesn't exist.
Who is the likely Democratic nominee in 2020?
Who knows? I mean, I'll close on this. I mean, I think a lot of people are looking at Trump as the sort of model going forward. He's the exact opposite of Barack Obama, you know, in virtually everything. And you know, and so the question is you know, is the next nominee, is it more like Trump or is it completely the opposite of Trump? And you know, so I mean, I could make the argument that it, you know, it's somebody like a Mark Cuban, if we go that way, you know, who's a, you know, businessman, you know, out of the box, or, you know, but I suspect that the pushback against Trump will be sort of anti-Trump, that we'll have a more sort of establishment governor type. Who that is, I don't know. I don't think it'll be Joe Biden as much as I wish. He'll be 77 on Election Day in 2000. Though I tell you what, he's a 77-year-old who I would put in a boxing match with anybody. A guy's in amazing shape. But it's gonna be interesting. And frankly, too, one last thing, you know, Florida in 2018 is gonna be amazing too. I mean, we're gonna have, you know, every single cabinet office and the governorship is gonna be open. Depending upon what Bill Nelson does, you could have an open. I think he'll run, but if he doesn't, you could have as many as 6 open statewide elections in Florida in 2018. You know, it'll be fun. So.
And therein lies the last question. Give us your prediction for who the two nominees will be in 2018 for governor in Florida.
Well, I mean, I'm obviously biased on my side. You know, I think Gwen probably runs. I don't know that she's fully decided, but I think she probably runs. And I think in a lot of ways she sort of matches up really well with the problems that you saw in the election here for my party in 2016. Again, I also think that there's a pretty good chance that 2018 is going to be the year of the anti-Trump. And, you know, those of y'all that know Gwen know she's pretty much the opposite of Donald Trump in terms of temperament and approach and everything else. You know, I think on our side it's going to be interesting. I think John Morgan's probably going to run for governor. I think it's either going to be an amazing success or a complete utter failure. I don't think it'll be anywhere in between. You know, I think you're also going to see, you know, Philip Levine, who's a mayor of Miami Beach. He's a wealthy sort of self-funder type. I suspect Bob Buckhorn from Tampa probably gets in. I think one of the lessons of 2016 is going to be people aren't going to not run for office again. I don't think you'll see people sitting it out. Donald Trump taught us that you should get in and run and see what happens. And so I think politicians are going to learn that going forward. You know, on their side, I think Putnam is obviously the odds-on favorite, and you know, I think very highly of Adam. I think a Putnam-Graham race would be a really smart, high-minded race. You know, but I think in a lot of ways, I mean, depending upon how their party reacts to Trump, you know, Adam could be very poorly positioned in their primary. I mean, he's sort of very sort of establishment institutional guy. I mean, sort of the definition of a career politician, literally. You know, I suspect that there probably is, at least like Rick Scott, there's probably somebody on their side that we haven't heard of yet who will get in. But, you know, I'm actually very hopeful that it's a Putnam-Graham race. I say that not because I think it's a good race for Graham. I think Putnam would be a tough opponent. But I think it'd be a really good conversation for the state, and I'd feel very comfortable with either one of them as governor. So.
Well, Steve, that was really very interesting. You talked for a long time, but it was really interesting. Just want to let you know, we have a couple of meetings in the future. They're coming up. So if anybody wants to write this down, December 15th is going to be all the constitutional officers, superintendent of schools, Walt McNeil, everybody. You know the whole list. They're there. Not to name them. And then we're also going to have another one in January 19th. We're going to have Jeffrey Rosen, president. Wait, you can't call him president. CEO of the Constitutional Center out of Philadelphia. That's going to be a huge meeting, too, so you want to make that. So after that, this meeting is adjourned.